broadcasting from the Gulag city of Planet Earth. This is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. And in a few moments, we'll bring in our guest for the evening, Miss Valerie Corral of the WAM organization in Santa Cruz, California. But first, I want to point out that earlier today, we had a special panel, 2 hours on racial bias in the drug war. Our panelists included Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, Roger Goodman of the King County Bar Association, Sanho Tree, a fellow and director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Deborah Small, the coordinator of the forthcoming Breaking the Chains Conference on Racial Bias, scheduled for Houston, Texas. You can listen to that show already online at cultural-baggage.com. You know, you stop and think about it. How many times can you report the abuses of the police department, the district attorneys, and, you know, the various justice machine around the country? And it really boils down to as many times as you'll listen to it, as many times as you'll sit there and take it, you know, just take it like water off a duck's back. And even a duck gets tired of standing in the rain, my friends. And I'm hoping that you'll start standing up with me and helping to change these crazy laws. Steve, we have Valerie online. Let's go ahead and bring her on board.
Hello.
Good evening, Valerie.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm well. I figure before I get too wound up and agitated, I'm going to bring you on for your cooling thoughts on the subject of this crazy drug war.
Okay. See what I can do.
All right. Valerie, for those who may not know, tell folks a bit about what you've had to endure over the last year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm. About 30 years ago, I started using marijuana to treat epilepsy. My husband read in a medical journal that marijuana was successful in treating laboratory-induced seizures in rats. And I happen to be one of the 25% of epileptics that don't respond to pharmaceuticals, a plethora of medications, I might add, very strong. And none of them worked, so we tried marijuana. That led us to the first arrest in 1992, which led us to beginning an organization, a collective of mostly terminally ill patients who had contacted us at that time to see how we could help. We started a collective. We've been growing openly since that time, and our collective has grown to, as well, to about 250 people. And on September 5th of 2002, a little over a year ago, the DEA showed up at our home with guns and in their paramilitary gear, and about 20 to 30 of them, they came to arrest my husband and myself, and they did so with all their force, as, you know, that this is what one would imagine that they would do, just as seen on television. And they arrested us and took us away. In the meantime, we had a response team, which was very fortunate. We had any number of our patients poised to respond to several different circumstances or situations. One of them was that the DEA would come, and they came while the DEA was here and locked the gate. They came with media and about 30, 40 members perhaps, and they barricaded the road and locked the DEA in and ended up bargaining for our release. So it was quite a mixed day of mixed emotion. A day when your heart breaks, when you find that the work that you've done, the will of the people is ignored, and that acts of violence and terrorism and acts of fascism occur, and you happen to be standing in the way of that. So, you know, it's an interesting journey. I can just have been a very interesting journey.
Yes, Valerie, I know that anybody out there who putters around in their garden, whether they're growing tomatoes or corn or whatever, that you do take a certain pride of ownership and communion, if you will, with the earth and the goodness that it brings. And I know when it's your medicine and you see it ripening, which in September I'm certain it was beginning to, it must have seemed even more outrageous for their timing.
What's devastating is that this garden is attended. It's a wheelchair accessible garden. Our collective, we don't charge money. Patients can give. I mean, of course, they're encouraged to donate, but never is an allotment of a patient based on money, and neither is their membership. It's based on their need to be in, and presently it's primarily terminally ill people, because it's just so much of a of a demand. But what happens in the garden, and we have a sign over it that says love grows here, what happens in the garden is a multi-level approach of dealing not only with treating oneself, growing one's own medicine, but it's a place where people come together, that people come to be part of something greater than themselves, because the premise upon which WAM was founded is, and that's the Women's WO/Men Alliance for Medical Marijuana, the premise is to give what you can and take what you need, so that many of us, people who are ill, are disenfranchised by our illness. We often have a different group of friends after our illness, or many people walk away because it's difficult to watch suffering. It's a hard thing to do. And what we found is that while marijuana brings us together, it's hardly what holds us together. What holds us together is a deep understanding to suffering, having been made witness not only of our own but of others, and a commitment to alleviating that. Now, we know we're not God, and we know that marijuana is not a panacea. We're not duped into thinking that we're going to save the world or even change it. But it's very important to recognize that any patient, when he or she goes to his or her doctor, understands that a medicine that's treating the symptomology, that's relieving pain, relieving nausea, relieving neuropathy, relieving glaucoma, relieving seizure activity, spasm, quadriplegia, paraplegia, any of those associated illness symptoms with illness, that when you find an answer, what? I mean, your doctors never argue with you. They say, sure, take more Valium. Sure, take more OxyContin. But with marijuana, it's really quite a different thing. And my belief is because we have found a way to serve our own needs and to take the cost out of it. That's dangerous. That's a dangerous thing to do in a society that bases success not on the curing of human suffering or the relief of human suffering, but on commerce.
I saw a report, I think it was on Sunday, in the New York Times that indicated 15% of the gross national product of the United States of America is now spent on health care.
Well, you know, I can understand that. I mean, we're watching my father-in-law right now, observing him as he's facing illness and watching the system fail him. And he's 82 years old, you know, 83 years old, and we're watching the system. There's a man who's a dedicated Republican, you know, flying his flag.
Sure.
And seeing what's happening. I mean, watching himself, even though he's a Republican, he did vote for Proposition 215, the medical marijuana initiative. He even went and gathered signatures for it. So, but as we watch the system fail the people for whom it was created to serve, it was, you know, and it's remarkable. It's remarkable, but it doesn't disempower us. You know, we may be disenfranchised, but we are powerfully strong people who have faced illness and many people facing death, and the government pales. The government pales in their fear tactics, and not to say they don't create angst among our membership. I mean, many people have become much more frightened. 22 of our members have died since September 5th, 2002. You know, we have to be honest about the kind of suffering that it creates, but recognize that we live in a world of duality, a world of suffering, and you find your joy among the ordinary tasks of your life. You know, that's, if you can do that, then nobody can take that away from you. Not even this wretched government, this ruling party, this ruling class. You know,
I understand. Valerie, you know, I've heard stories that, did you say 85% of your patients are terminal?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've lost 22 of our members, and some members have quit because of the stress of suing the federal government. I mean, we filed two lawsuits against the federal government.
Tell us about those, please.
Okay, well, the first lawsuit, which is not one of the two, it's the Conant McCaffrey case, which is or Conant v. Walters, which is a patient physician rights, First Amendment rights issue, which just the Supreme Court, even after George Bush Jr., asked the Supreme Court to hear. They refused to hear it. We've won every time. And it's the privilege of patient and doctor confidentiality to talk about medical marijuana. Soon after the Proposition 215 had passed in California, the federal government came out to threaten doctors, saying, we'll take you... we'll take your prescriptive license away and also fine you at least $25,000 or imprisonment for even speaking about marijuana with your patients. You know, so we won. That was the first case. We won that. And it's, you know, there's no such thing as a small victory.
No, not in this.
Not in this. No, you have to count every one of them as huge. Then we filed for return of property, meaning we got everything back from the feds, but they didn't give us our marijuana back, so we filed against the federal government for return of property. Now, it's a long shot. However, it's mostly about standing up against injustice. Whether or not we win becomes... is it a moot point? Not really, but it becomes not so necessary to get our medicine back. But what does become necessary is that you stand against the violator, that you don't allow, no matter where in your life there's someone violates you, that you don't allow it to continue silently and roll over, because this is what our government has lauded themselves upon doing, where they wreak fear into, you know, promulgating fear. And it, not to say it doesn't get scary some nights or mornings, sometimes it does, but at the same time I recognize that this is a very important stand. So we are pressing with that lawsuit. It's moving to the Ninth Circuit. It's in the Ninth Circuit Court for review, and we're awaiting a judgment. Our third lawsuit, which is a lawsuit that both the City of Santa Cruz and the County of Santa Cruz has signed on to, is an injunction against the federal government to allow us to continue our work as a collective, a group of patients who all of us have recommendations from our physicians. Nobody in our organization works for without either being a legal caregiver or a legal patient. So everyone is covered. And in that, we hope to have the right to continue our work, to grow our marijuana in our collective garden, which allows patients access to the garden. You know, so I mean, it's interesting, in all these years of almost 30 years of growing medicine, the only thefts that have ever occurred have been those by sheriffs or our government, by agents that work, you know, that are supposed to work to protect the citizenry. Instead, they have done everything but that. Now, of course, some years later, 10 years of working on this issue, I work with the local police and sheriff. I work with... in the city and the county, we've put together a county ID system. I mean, a really important kind of patient identification and caregiver identification program. Really have created dialogue, because without communication, we remain in adverse positions. As long as we can keep the dialogue and the communication open, we can come to some understanding. I mean, there is no such thing as a problem that can't be solved. There just isn't.
You're absolutely right, Valerie. We're going to take just a little break here. I want to kind of postulate a question or a scenario we can talk about when we come back. And
okay.
That's maybe what, how will you follow in the footsteps, if you will, of Angel versus Ashcroft? And we'll be right back.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of DrugSense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Confusion, anxiety, fatigue, tingling in the fingers, blurred vision, loss of consciousness, excessive phlegm, brown urine, unusual bleeding, nausea, and vomiting. Time's up. The answer, Glipizide for diabetics.
Had long hair and a goatee, and if his eyes were pretty glazed, if he looked spaced out, would you buy his story? Would you believe he had an eye infection?
Okay, Valerie, you were saying there's no such thing as a small task met, I forget, goal made or something.
Victory, yeah.
And, you know, following in the footsteps, say, of Ed Rosenthal and trails he's been blazing in, and Angel and Miss Monson have done here, tell us, well, you know, how do you follow in the work that they've done?
Well, they're really not related. I mean, the only relationship is marijuana for medical use.
Okay.
First of all, we're not growers. We don't sell marijuana. We don't grow marijuana for resale to clubs. And secondly, as far as Angel Raich and Diane Monson go, that is an individual case for them as individuals to use marijuana in the Ninth Circuit. Probably our cases will, it's likely they may be enjoined to go to the Supreme Court, not Ed Rosenthal's, of course, but the thing with Ed Rosenthal is that he, you know, what happened there is that it's part, that's more of a relationship to what happened with alcohol prohibition. It's just people getting tired of being, getting the runaround lied to by the federal government and really knowing something else to be true. Also, there is a law in our state, a law to which obviously many people ascribe. So that's kind of there's no small victory. I mean, these are victories. When a judge says, okay, you get one day, and you've been convicted of a felony, up to where you could serve 5 to 10 years, you know, this is quite extraordinary. And you can relate this right back to prohibition on alcohol. And I think as much the same is true. The thing that was remarkable is Judge Pragerson did in his findings or his opinion of the findings from the Ninth Circuit state that the circuit court judge in Judge Jeremy Fogel, in his findings where he did not return the property of Wham, he said that he erred, that the judge did err, that he made a mistake, he misread and misunderstood the federal law. And however, the difference is that our case works on the 10th the 5th Amendment. It works in a federalism case. It's really quite different from Angel and Diane's case. So will it help? I think what we can safely say is that it is the mood of the nation. It's a reflection of the obviously what those in the court system are thinking and feeling, and it that reflects the mood of the nation, or you know, at least certainly the Ninth Circuit.
I appreciate that. No, the distinctions you've drawn are quite easily understood now that you've explained them, and I thank you for that. You know, the thing that strikes me as odd. I mean, I live in Texas. This is a very backwoods part of the country, and. But out there, there are these clubs where with a doctor's prescription, people can in fact buy. There are people who are willing to stand up in their city councils and demand a change. You know, whereas here it's just so hard to get people motivated. What could you tell those folks here? What would get them off their heinies and to go talk to the city council?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I think there are two things that motivate people. It's kind of unfortunate. you know, fear and motive, fear and suffering, and I think we could put both of those in the same category.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I think that joy also can motivate people. Unfortunately, most of us are rather quiet until we find our own lives or freedom threatened. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? I don't know. Everybody's got to do what's right for them. I mean, I don't look at my work as being what's going to change the world. I don't think about it in those terms. And I don't think that, I mean, I'm a small part of something that's huge. Nobody, you know, you read a newspaper. There are a million newspapers with a billion names. So every day. So who's going to remember anyone? If we look at ourselves as part of something greater, and we recognize that our work, if it's anything, is to be true to our experience, true to what we know to be true, then I think that we can overcome our fear. I would say this. I've more than 120 of my friends and family members have died, and I have been at the bedside of many of those. But that is part of what WHAM does, is we are an integral part of one another's lives, not just marijuana. It's only a small part of what we do every week. But what I have noticed is that the way one lives is the way that one approaches death. I've been very honored to be asked to sit by the bedside of someone who's dying. I don't know anything about death, and I don't claim to be any expert, but I can say I know about sitting by and observing. And as I watch this to be so, I realize that every day I have an opportunity to either deny the truth or to live it. And am I right? Well, everybody thinks they're right. So I try to put that aside. Oh, I'm more right than you. The DEA came, and most of them thought they were right, although I will tell you that several people were looking very verklempt that day. And another one of the DEA agents said to us, you know, I'm going to think about getting another job sometime soon.
Good.
So we had 8.5 hours to spend with those men, to talk to them, to impart what we knew and what we had understood in our experience. And experience is a powerful teacher. And as a matter of fact, it is the one. It is the one that changes each of us. And when we look at our mortality, I think that if we look at that, not in a negative and horrifying, terrible, oh my God, terrible thing, but that it's something that's natural as life. And if we look at that and we say that this moment is practice for that moment, it helps us to erase our fears. It helps us to know that the only thing there really is to stand for in this life is our truth. And that is where your freedom comes. That's when you can get you could want $1 million your whole life. You could get your $1 million and say, hey, wait, I got my $1 million, but now, I'm still empty inside. Why is that? So I think that to change the world, my opinion, there's just my little opinion out here in Santa Cruz, but to change the world, we must change ourselves. We must really go inside and look, really observe. You know, why am I so afraid to speak the truth? If I can't get you to a city council meeting, I don't know what can.
Really, really, you know? Valerie, you're so on the money. I thank you for that. Now, if you will, the thing that I find really invigorating as well, reading about it from here, is the fact that many of the counties and the cities are actually deputizing good folks like you to be representative of the community in these endeavors. Would you talk about that a minute?
Right. Well, many years ago, looking through the Controlled Substances Act, and it was an attorney who saw this. It's a CSA, a Controlled Substances Act 885D, and in there it's a notation that any agent of any government body, from city to the feds, cannot be arrested if he or she is acting as an agent of the city, thereby being deputized. Now, what that means is the caveat there is that narcotics agents, narcs, can set people up, do drugs, sell drugs, buy drugs, do the whole thing, use drugs, but they are free from prosecution because they're involved in a legal sting or legal operation. And so what our idea was, and I mean, we called explained this to everybody once we heard about it. It took a few years for Santa Cruz to do it. We move very slowly in Santa Cruz, thereby we hope making fewer mistakes. But that is something that cities are doing. Mike and I are deputized, for instance. We, just a few days after the raid, we had a giveaway where the city, on the steps of City Hall, ex-mayors, the mayors, the supervisors of our county, doctors, supporters from many different aspects of our community, and 1,200 people came on a Tuesday afternoon to watch us do a kind of representation, a giveaway of our marijuana, a public display where we gave away marijuana to patients that day. It's pretty remarkable. So these are the kinds of things that draw people together. The deputization is a legal step. It's a step. Is it symbolic? Probably. But it's a very powerful step that one takes. That deputization, I'm sure, could be refuted by the federal government, may well be. However, what's important about it is that everything we do that stands in the face, in opposition of this accelerated drug war, one that would even include denying relief to people who are suffering by this administration in a very cruel hoax the preponderance of their cruel hoax is really strengthening. So you go to your city council, you take names, you meet, you talk with people, you talk with each other, you build your community, because if you're alone, you know, pretty soon they come for you. You can't stand by and watch them come for everyone else. There's something very true about that. So this is another step in joining together or calling together your support. I mean, one of the first things I did when I started publicly doing WHAM, and my husband Mike and I started publicly in 1993, was I joined the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Commission, because I realized that there are people who would think me the enemy. How could I speak to them? How could I understand what they saw as the problem if I didn't know who they were and if I didn't recognize what their language? You know, it's very important to, it's a lot of work, but I mean, it's very important to be inclusive in our community so you don't alienate people.
Well, Valerie, we've got about 30 seconds left here. I want to wrap this up just by saying thank you and your husband Mike, and my salute and my hats off to all of the good folks at WHAM and the just the perseverance, and God bless y'all. I mean, it's wonderful to know there's people like you out there that really care.
Well, thank you so much. The truth is mighty. It will prevail.
Thank you, Valerie Corral.
Appreciate your help.
You bet. We'll have this show up online for the network tomorrow, and I want to thank you know, the guests from earlier today as well, Eric Sterling, Roger Goodman, Sanho Tree, Deborah Small. We've had a great day of drug reform here on the Drug Truth Network, and I want to thank all the listeners out there for being a part of it. You know, and as always in closing, you know, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag, so I beg you to please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.